here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Save big money on your next outdoor project at Menards. Menards has the best in-stock selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber. Our huge inventory of decking, fencing, lumber, and timbers are all easy to load in our drive-thru lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our fence and deck design programs in-store or online at Menards.com. Don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast. It's where we look into the hidden Mickeys behind the mouse of magic. I don't even know what that means. Okay. Hi, this is Matt here. As always, joining me is Thomas, the paranoid American.
That's right, paranoid as ever.
That, right on. Okay. We're doing a shorter episode, but a twofer. We're going to start by putting our toe a little bit outside of animation with the gnome mobile, although I guess technically it has animatronics. That was kind of cool.
And this was a special request that was well worth it, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting detour. And you know, the other one is bed knobs and brooms. I want to say boomsticks, thinking about Army of Darkness or something. Bed knobs and broomsticks, which has a little bit of animation, I guess.
I want to watch the hybrid. I definitely want to watch the hybrid that you just mentioned, the knobs and boomsticks. I'm already thinking about it.
They show up on their trans-dimensionally traveling bed and pop a cap or two in folks. Yeah, I'd like to see that. And deadites. We're just in the middle of, the West End or something. That'd be fun too, I guess.
They can still keep the Nazi theme, honestly. Now all of a sudden it's versus the Nazis.
Oh yeah, and then to get a Castle Wolfenstein sort of vibe. Yeah, or man, something. I'm
already into this. I'm already invested.
So obviously, this is a frontline Disney production of the time, and I'm going, well, both of them really, but more so with the Gnomobile. I had straight up never heard of it before until you brought it up. So
me either. It had just recently come up, and it was on a conspiracy little podcast that I was doing with some friends, and they mentioned two things I'd never heard of. One was Gnomobile, which was the easier one to track down. The other one was that there's a possibility that Walt Disney himself was invited to the Bohemian Club at some point, and he was even considering a special projection system that would work and project against the redwood trees in like a specific area. And it almost made, the way it was being described, made me think of like this 3D projection mapping that you see where people will project on like the side of a building and it looks all 3D and things are happening, but it's just projected light. It almost sounded like a crude earlier version of that, but for whatever reason, it likely did not happen. And Walt also went and joined or created his own little secret society that was almost counter to the Bohemian Grove. So it feels like there might have been some kind of a falling out. I dug in deep to try and find more about this. I couldn't, but I did come back with the Gnomobile, which I feel is still a decent sort of little booty that I got to bring back as a victor.
I wonder if that kind of projection technology did eventually end up. I haven't been on it because I haven't been in Florida for years, but there's the Runaway Railway, which apparently has a lot of like basically plane surfaces with 3D projection. So that might be like the ultimate version of that. Not a movie, of course, it's a ride, but
I want to learn more. If I find anything else out about it, you can be sure I'll bring it up at some point.
But that, and I think Rise of the Resistance as well, it's the sort of thing where you go through a room and then you go to a smaller room, turn around, and the lights have, the projections have made that first room into a completely different setting. So that's cool. I haven't experienced it myself, though. I just watched the YouTube videos, you know.
It's almost like one of those VR experiences where they can tell when you've turned your head completely around. So then when you turn your head back around, they can just spawn a completely different world without you really perceiving the change.
Exactly. So and then you're on the trackless ride vehicle. So it sounds cool. I you know, next time I'm in the States, I'll maybe try and get down there and do that. But I wonder what would freak me out more, being in a room with all those projections by myself, or being in a full running It's a Small World by myself. I'm not quite sure which one would be more disconcerting. I get, you know, just lots of light and flashing, and yeah, I don't know. This movie's pretty chill though. I don't, in a way, I guess. I mean, it certainly has that like Sunday afternoon, I'm mildly bored feel to it.
It felt like it was put together with a bunch of B-roll or like things that were shot in between other things that didn't give as much attention. It didn't feel like a fully qualified movie that everyone really put their heart and soul into. And I don't mean any offense to anyone that's still alive that was involved in the making, but it absolutely felt like a, not even a straight to TV, but you know, so almost like a freebie. Like this would have been something that they just gave out to someone if they went and saw a matinee.
Well, Ed Wynn, who is the Gnome King, I mean, he basically was on death's door making this. So this being his final film. And I think I've seen him show up in the Twilight Zone a bit, too, because I've been doing those. we get the creepy factor because our Mary Poppins kids have returned. Karen Dutrice and Matthew Garber. Yeah.
And they're introduced as such on the title credits.
I know, it's in a different movie.
It just says the Mary Poppins kids, because it's like, we know that you've never heard of any of these people before. So here's something that might give them a chance.
Yeah, that's like when your reputation creates some horrible nickname that you can't shake even when you like meet new people, you know?
Like, and it's kind of true because, I mean, the kid died when he was in his early 20s in India from
hepatitis, it said.
There's multiple stories. Yeah, there's a lot of stories. And then the girl didn't necessarily do a lot. She kind of just dropped out of the acting industry altogether. So they truly always were the Mary Poppins kids. Mm-hmm. And even if you go and see them in Gnomemobile, they're still introduced as the Mary Poppins kids. So that's basically what their title remains in Disney lore.
And part of the conceit of this film seems to be sort of like, oh, you love them so much and how cute they were in Mary Poppins. Here they are again. And in their own feature, I'm like, no, I didn't like them in Mary Poppins. Yeah. That was probably the thing I liked the least about Mary Poppins. These disconcerting children. Yeah. I mean,
honestly, you're making a strong point, and I feel like I might just agree by default for now that the kids were probably the most boring aspect of Mary Poppins. This is a rare instance where all the adults were the interesting ones and the kids were kind of dragging everyone else back.
I mean, this one definitely makes up for it with, you know, gnomes and weird animatronics in a redwood forest. So I'll take that.
It is creepy, and it has those connotations of they're definitely in Bohemian Grove because of the redwood forest. Like you just have to accept that. But it also takes this really weird turn. Like first, there's almost like a philosophical crisis where there's no women left and there's this one young gnome and he has to figure out how to repopulate. And automatically I'm just thinking about like Book of Genesis or like one of those early biblical tales where you're like, all right, who's the least my sister right now out of everyone in here? Who's least my sister?
I went darker and thought the last act of 28 Days Later. it's not even the repopulating world, it's just England at that point.
Well, and this one was just this little section of the woods, apparently, which they haven't even really ventured out because they didn't go that much farther to find another huge little enclave of gnomes. I'm not sure what you call a gaggle of gnomes. Just make some up. And then they're just like, oh, nomenclature. Oh, I hate you. That's good. That's so good. But they just find like this huge swath of, you know, gnome women. And now all of a sudden it went from I'll take anything I get to pick your best out of like these 20 or 30 options. But I was also wondering how many of those are related. Like, are there that many families out there, or are they also sort of at the same, you know, crisis where like inbreeding is just one generation away?
Well, I was trying to work out like if we are groving here. At first I was like, oh, is Five Oaks the grove itself? And I don't know, they dance with the spirits of gnomes out in the redwood forest. Because Five Oaks is the sanitarium, I guess, but I feel like they could be cover for your weird, you know, rich guy get-togethers or something.
Well, and I mean, it's so sparse out there that you would hear whatever was going on, but you might not even see it. And we only see a tiny little bit of these redwood forests, but they imply that they own all of it. Like everything there is to see, that he basically owns most of it, and that they've been clearing it out and I guess massacring these gnomes in the process. They don't show anything, but they definitely imply that it's been essentially like a gnome holocaust that's just decimated the gnome population, which kind of leads them into this situation where all of a sudden they're almost facing extinction.
Is anyone ever actually taking down the redwoods? I'm pretty sure you can't now. I don't know. I've been to Muir Woods, so that's like my image of this thing.
You got that Disney clout, I'm sure you can chop down as many redwoods as you want, though, especially when this movie was made.
Yeah, I guess, being in the mid 60s, it might be a little bit different. But we got Vertigo where they're looking at all the rings of redwood. So at that point, people probably had in their mind it's a bad idea to chop these really old things down. Although someone had to chop that one down to show you the ring, so can't see the rings without chopping down the tree.
You can't see the gnomobile without chopping down some redwoods in the process, I assume.
Oh yeah, not down with the gnomobile song. I was like, this is a bad song. I don't know if you've seen the Fantastic Mr. Fox where they're having their hoe down, and then who does the James Cromwell? Someone does the voice of the rich old guy. Is like, stop it. He's like, that was a bad song.
He wanted the narrator to come out and shut it down on this one.
I wanted the gnomobile song shut down. Yeah.
It was very annoying. And the way that they were singing it and how passionate they were about being in this gnomobile, it was pretty annoying.
I mean, it's an old car, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then he was like so proud of like an even older car, which at this point might as well have been, you know, like a fossil. I didn't even bother looking it up. I don't know if you took down the name of the car that he was bragging about that he had before this one.
I think it was white, but I could be remembering it wrong. That's all I got. It was white. Well, I do remember hearing my grandma talking about jump seats and never quite figuring out what that was. So it probably had a jump seat.
Yeah, I mean, he was all about it, and the kids didn't seem as impressed as anyone else. And then they burst into this incredibly annoying and overly rehearsed song where everyone was, you could see them like almost mouthing the words, getting ready for their part where they would sing in spontaneously. And I don't know. I just, musicals in general annoy me. So this one, it kind of represented some of the ways that I don't like musicals being incorporated. I loved Jungle Book musical, and I love some of the other earlier story. I think Sword in the Stone had a couple, maybe for nostalgia reasons. This one, though, I don't see any redeeming qualities about a single song that comes up, nostalgia or not.
Yeah, I mean, in Bedknobs specifically, I remember one of the songs starting as the answer to a question. If someone asks you a question, you answer with a song. That's annoying. That's not cool.
That's so Disney.
Yes, it is very Disney. I mean, I guess it's very Broadway too. I'm not that knowledgeable of show tunes and stuff. Not things I tend to listen to. Although
we're in the thick of it with these movies that we've been watching. We're right in the thick of the cross between show tunes and Hollywood almost.
Yeah, now that we've gone live action for a few, for sure. So that is weird. Live action Disney films until Tron, and probably including Tron, have a weird clunkiness to them. I don't know if it's that the film crews weren't like as, you know, spit and polished maybe as the Paramount or the Fox people or what.
A little bit of that. And honestly, both of these movies clunky for different reasons. To me, the Gnomobile movie was clunky just because it really did feel like they were on a road trip between two different projects and decided to shoot a movie in between. So there's a lot of the songs are over rehearsed, but there's also some scenes that feel like they just kind of winged it, or maybe someone flubbed something. And they were just like, no one's expecting much out of this movie. We'll just keep it. Just keep the camera rolling. But then Bedknobs and Broomsticks, that one felt like they had to step on an exact spot every 3 to 5 seconds, and they had to say things in like very specific times, and there was almost no room for any kind of that that amateur feeling improv that we got from No Mobile. It was almost the exact opposite. Like it was over engineered.
Yeah. Was it Bed Knobs you wanted to hit song lyrics on, or did you actually want to look at the No Mobile lyrics?
No, I don't really care much about the specific No Mobile lyrics. Really, the feather in the cap for No Mobile is just how incredibly weird and and forgotten this movie is, and that essentially it's a little bit crass, and that they're just trying to get this dude laid and just going on an adventure to get this little gnome guy hooked up. And then even when it gets to the hookup part, it's a little bit creepy about it, because it's like, who do you want to take possession of? And then it turns into, oh no. And I quote the movie, and I believe this was completely out of cultural context, but it was something like, it's the shemale who chooses, not the male. And I believe they called the female gnomes shemales in the context of this movie. And then they all chase this guy down, and it turns into like a big obstacle course slash, like tag you're it kind of deal. And that's how, procreation essentially works. So I wonder if interesting concept.
67, you were just supposed to say it not like she male, but she male. Like that's just
like email.
Yeah, like it's one word. Like they just kind of changed the fee to she, right?
I mean, I watched it with the captions on, and it definitely had the hyphen in between. And I know it's not what it would have been now, but it was an interesting, because I couldn't figure out why they would, specify that. So it was just an interesting little quirk. It was a hidden Mickey.
Also, in the crassness, I was thinking about like when he takes a fishing hook and the arse, that would actually be a pretty bloody mess.
Yeah, when he has to catch him, he's trying to get away. They have this caricature sort of like evil, guy with the bowling hat. And, I don't know. I appreciated how quickly the movie moved along, and it was very formulaic. And I was never questioning, is this going to end soon? It always felt like it was just about to end, because I don't know. It was definitely like on a straight course. And it followed this formula that I was comfortable with. Whereas Bedknobs and Broomsticks was a little all over the place. And actually, before I even get into that movie and the lyrics, because I do have some lyrics from it, you said that you've got some nostalgia ties to it, which I completely don't have. And I think this is inverted from some of the previous movies that we watched together.
I'm going to see if I can find an image of it real quick. I think I was very entranced by the VHS box for this one. EHS Bed Knobs. Something about the box was very alluring to me as a child. Let's see if I can find that. No, that's not it. Is this one
that you actually owned?
I didn't. I got it multiple times from the VHS store. Yeah, okay, here we go. It's kind of tiny. See if we can get it there. I guess just the fact that it had like the cartoon characters and the people in the same shot maybe got my attention as a kid, because that was still kind of a novelty, in the early 80s. I mean, Roger Rabbit was super exciting for doing that. So I guess it was, yeah. And I really loved Roger Rabbit too, and that came out. So I guess I just had a thing as a child for putting animated characters and real people on the screen together. And there weren't many options at this point in time. Which is weird. I didn't watch Mary Poppins. I almost
feel a little offended that you mentioned Roger Rabbit in the same sentence as this movie.
Oh, that's a great movie. I took the floppy disk of the video game to my fourth grade class and played it for an hour before school every day in front of all my
Roger Rabbit?
Yeah.
Did you ever play the NES version of Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
No, I had the PC one. So
I don't know if it was the same on the PC, but in the NES version, if you went into the club where Jessica Rabbit was singing and checked under a table, it gave you like an 800 number that you could call. And it was like, call me sometime, big guy. And if you called it, it would give you some hint about the game, about like you can throw, dog treats at the dogs and they'll leave you alone or something. But it was done in Jessica Rabbit's voice. I always thought that was the most wild. I mean, this was pre-1985. This must have been like 85 or 86 at the latest. And it just blew my mind that you're playing this game and then you could get up from the game and go and make a phone call and talk to the girl that you just saw in the game. In all of her 8, bit pixel goodness.
Yeah, I think it's probably a couple years later in that, though, because wasn't Roger Rabbit 88 or 89, I think? Anyway, we're going to be talking about Roger Rabbit at some point because that goes on this, you know, trajectory. So I was thinking, though, I mean, I had my plush Roger Rabbit as a kid. Did they make a plush Jessica Rabbit? I was just imagining some kid walking around with a little plush Jessica Body Rabbit. Yeah, that's what that basically becomes. What I hear recently, I think I heard someone said they put like a ring, like a, not a ring, well, yeah, like a big raincoat, a trench coat on Jessica Rabbit on the Roger Rabbit ride. And I was like, oh, that's not cool.
So the game was 89. You're right. Yeah. The NES game was 1989.
Okay. But yeah, because everyone else had the NES, right? So they couldn't bring it to school and load it onto the school computer like I could with my PC version. So that's why I was cool.
Well, that was before everyone was guaranteed to have a PC. That was like one out of however many.
And then I failed science class. I think I turned it around, but yeah, I remember in the fourth grade failing science class for a while. I don't even remember.
Played enough Number Munchers.
Something like that. I was too busy playing Roger Rabbit. I guess we'll move that trajectory to bed knobs and broomsticks. I almost said it wrong because you might see my note title. There's bedpans and gnome sticks. So just yesterday I had like weird like names going through my head all day. So I could never remember the real name of the movie.
For me, I didn't have any nostalgia for this movie. In fact, I don't remember watching it, but I'm sure I did because a couple of the songs and especially the fish animation scene was really familiar to me. But the entire movie annoyed me to hell. And I feel like maybe I was annoyed when I originally watched this as a kid at some point. But every scene felt new as I was watching it, but it was new in a boring way.
Oh, I know. And I'm not really going to bat for this movie, but I'm trying to explain what the allure was to Lil Matt. The bed transportation scenes were like still completely up my alley. You know, I hadn't seen Willy Wonka when I first saw this. I hadn't seen the Willy Wonka boat ride. So this was like probably my gold standard for this sort of thing. I watched 2001 a lot as a kid too. I was like little 8-year-old Matt was like watching 2001 every like 2 weeks.
And Bedknobs and Broomsticks. What an interesting, alternates there.
Well, I mean, it has the, you know, this similar effects for the flying over landscape stuff, right? As flying over the Jupiter moon or whatever it's supposed to be at the end of that movie.
I mean, I was huge into Little Nemo because there was, I think, an adaptation that didn't get huge in the US, but I think there was like an anime adaptation of Little Nemo, and then also the comics, and again an NES game. So definitely Little Nemo. When I saw Bedknobs and Broomsticks, I would always think of Little Nemo and then wish it was as cool as Little Nemo.
I'm also thinking Disney, before they were willing to actually put films out, this would being one of the earlier films they would put out on VHS because they were still like, go see our theatrical re-releases at the time. That might be another reason I rented this a few times, because they didn't have Snow White or Dumbo, right? They had Bedknobs and Broomsticks, because Dumbo was in the vault, right? You were supposed to wait for the next theatrical re-release. So
did this one never get into the vault? Was it just not vault quality?
I don't think most of the live action ones were considered vault quality. And like, I don't think this did badly when it came out, but it certainly didn't light the world on fire or anything either. But the first strategy when they're like, we have to do something about VHS, was compiling bits of music. So you'd have like one song from Dumbo followed by a song from Pinocchio. And maybe they just shove like the fish from this in, you know, that sort of thing. So there's tons of compilations that do that. People a few years younger than us would have had those, you know, Disney sing-along videos. There's one at Disneyland that's like pretty insane. It suggests that the characters actually run Disneyland and do the cleaning and stuff.
They probably do. It's just that it's a poor guy in a suit and they force him to also clean.
yeah, that's it. But it's the other characters force him. It's like the inmates are their own wardens, you know. I'll send you that video.
Stanford Prison Experiment, just Disney.
Well, that doesn't seem like that much of a stretch.
No. And honestly, this particular movie, this Bedknob Broomsticks movie, it's fascinating to me in that if you were to just write it all down on paper and told me what it was about, who was in it, and that it was half cartoon, half movie, I would be all in. This would just sound like the coolest little cult classic movie. But somehow they managed to make cartoons and fighting Nazis just kind of a little bit of a snooze fest. And I'm still bitter about it.
I don't think Angela Lansbury is probably the right choice. They probably thought they were going to get like a mature Julie Andrews vibe. And no slight against her. I mean, obviously she was a very talented lady, but maybe not quite the right one for this role. She doesn't seem whimsical, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess Julie Andrews turned this one down and Angela Lansbury got it. And this, you made a note here, which I didn't pick up on until I read your note, but even in this movie, which is pretty old and not that far into her career, she looks a little bit old already. And not in like a bad way, but just in that you went from Mary Poppins to like Mary Poppins' mom's sister that, you know, never wed. And it was just like a weird sort of sidestep. That felt like a downgrade. Like they should have done something, you know, off, like out of the ordinary, I think, for this one. Although it is kind of interesting that we got the gaslight lady, like Mary Poppins. We were talking about how she just gaslights the kids. Like, oh no, we never went anywhere. What are you talking about? You know? And now we literally get Angela Lansbury, who's the one where the gaslighting term came from.
Yeah. I mean, I guess she's here because she sings well, you know, and they're like, well, hopefully the rest will just like pan itself out. But I did think it was funny at the first scene when they're getting all the kids, you know, to their foster homes or whatever. I just assumed that the first set of kids were probably the Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe kids, you know, going off to a more popular tale. But we're stuck with the Bedknobs and Broomstick one.
And as forgettable as the Mary Poppins kids are, I think these kids are even a little bit more forgettable. So they might have even been able to do like a hat trick here. They should have put the Mary Poppins kids in this one too. And it would have made it a little bit more interesting, maybe.
Oh, they would have been totally awkward looking in 1971, though. You would have had like these like right, you know, prepubescent creepy twins, right? But of course, the one kid is, I guess, supposed to be just hitting puberty or whatever, because he's like, I don't believe in this stuff anymore, right? So, and then that's where she has to answer with a song. So the other one, I was just thinking like, you know, it's supposed to be this World War II, like magic and Nazis thing. I'm like, okay, yeah. Like you said, on paper, maybe it sounds good, but watching it, you're like, the fantasy of this movie can't match the Crowley Hess magic duel. That's the movie I need to be watching.
Well, so there is some interesting backstory to this, because the movie, in a very loose way, is based on Dion Fortune. And Dion Fortune was like a huge occultist, and one of the things that she was kind of, one of the interesting trivia tidbits that she was known for is that she would cast all of these spells against Hitler for World War II. And this actually happened all across the West, which is a little unknown fact. But there was also this movie called The Seventh Victim that I think from, I'm gonna get the year wrong, but I think it was like 1943 or something. And this was a movie that was co-written by Bodine DeWitt, who was a personal assistant to Aldous Huxley at the time. And he was writing all these horror movies, and he was trying to get some background information and got linked up through RKO, the film company, with an actual Satanist coven, or what, that's what they called it in this memoir about DeWitt that I had read. And that he goes to this place in Greenwich Village, New York, like a nice ritzy upper class area, and it was all upper class Satanists, and that they all just kind of like were, when he went up there, they were casting spells against Hitler. And when I read the bio for Dion Fortune, it was almost exactly the same, you know, same thing that she was doing, only she was doing it from over the pond, whereas this one was happening in Greenwich Village. So it sounds like there's this very real direct link to Dion Fortune, who was essentially the inspiration for Angela Lansbury in this movie.
I mean, we still have that going on now, right? I mean, sometimes you'll see on Facebook or something where people are like, hey, at this time, we're all going to get together and have the intention about this, you know?
Oh, well, now it sounds, you know, it's a little bit more acceptable just because people find themselves a little bit easier. To me, I guess it's just fascinating that such like eccentric sort of belief systems still found each other off the internet, you know, and big enough to congregate into like these large cities and you know, have all this influence, and then in turn, you know, inspire Disney movies, which is why we've got this podcast talking about these interesting occult connections to Disney that just come out of left field sometimes.
I mean, in a way, the multi-dimensional traveling bed is kind of like a analog internet, you know? It's like sending an email to to our huckster guy. I'm missing his name. You know, because now you'd send him an email, right? So here you have to take a bed through time and space. Well, space at least.
Well, and so those are the two sort of symbols presented in the title of this movie. The bed knob represents this magical teleportation device that can bring you to different dimensions and times and places. And then the broomstick is, you know, not beyond just the witch's broomstick, which is the obvious one, but this one kind of represents being able to rise above like the physical world, or like put the physical world at your command, because now you can fly around and you can use this inanimate object as kind of like your token to this world. So we have lots of deep symbolism just in the title of the movie alone.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you have to sit there and think about it for a few minutes, right? It's a bit of a strange title. Nice alliteration. I keep, you know, mumbling it into like different names, so that's kind of fun too. But yeah, I guess I think
it's a little bit of a mouthful. It doesn't roll. Bed knobs and broomsticks does not roll off the tongue.
I guess I never really figured out what a bed knob is, even though it's obvious. Yeah, probably because my bed growing up didn't have any knobs on it, so it was confusing.
Yeah, honestly, it seems like a dangerous accessory that no one really needs anymore. What is the point of a bed knob? Like, what? Why would you even have one versus none? Aesthetics or function?
Yeah, I guess you could need that for a canopy bed. I'm not sure. Do you put a canopy?
Yeah, but there was no canopies in these ones, right?
Yeah, yeah. I've never had any beds with those things. Oh, wait. No, last time I lived in the States, I think on our apartment, we had a couple, not knobs, but, you know, it came up a little bit. So if you spend enough time in your bed, you remember what some of them look like.
So if you don't have bed knobs, then you've got no chance of traversing dimensions, unfortunately. So yeah. Maybe that's the reason. That's the reason why you want to upgrade.
That's right. Yes, yes. And all witches and wizards need bed knobs on their beds. And they need the spells of Asestroth. Am I saying that right? They say in the movie. I think I'm just like spittering out wrong.
I'll butcher it as bad as you would. I would say like Astaroth.
Yeah, yeah. That definitely stuck out as, you know, something of things we like to talk about these days. Weird old grimoires and things, right? I guess that counts as grimoire, is it?
Well, yeah, the grimoires are basically the magical manuals from the Middle Ages. And there are some straight up incantations in here, because I can't even pronounce all the words again, but it's like Triguna, Makotes, Tricorum, Satis D, which is like the magical incantation that she's constantly saying. And that roughly, I mean, this was created by the Sherman brothers. It wasn't, as far as I'm aware, it didn't come from like an old Yiddish, you know, grimoire. It was just the Sherman brothers kind of having fun, but they were supposed to translate to wood, metal, earth, water, fire. So it's kind of Captain Planet-y in a way. I mean, Captain Planet's essentially making the exact same invocations.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I guess the Sherman brothers enjoyed writing gibberish was their thing anyway. They were like the geniuses of gibberish, maybe. I don't know if
they got a lot of inspiration from Yiddish folk songs for sure. So some of it sounds like gibberish, and I think it was based in what maybe just would sound like gibberish if you didn't know a lot of Yiddish, which I don't. So it does.
And then in this movie, the Portobello Road song, I guess, was the insanity inducing one, and it seemed like a mildly racist place.
Oh yeah, dude. Not only was it racist, but within the context of the movie, we're talking about World War II. Like, it opens up on Nazis. Like, it's not like a subtle tone. Like, it is exclusively about World War II Nazis at the beginning. There's swastikas in the credits. So when they start talking about Portobello Road, and it's where you can find all of these heirlooms and genuine gems and gold and crystals, thinking like, this is just the Nazi gold trail. Like, you guys are peddling and stolen Nazi, you know, booty. This is not something to make a song about.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. And I was just writing about the song. I'm assuming this has now been going on for hours and this place sucks, but it's also evil. Okay.
Well, they say the pen used by Shelley, as in Mary Shelley, you know, Frankenstein, which is about the Bavarian Illuminati for another episode, Waterford crystals, Napoleon's pistols, society heirlooms and genuine gems, and on and on and on. That's actually a fairly long song with a bunch of really weird lyrics, but it's about, and I always thought of like the dark web or like the Silk Road. Like, they're just peddling in illegal goods here, things that would get you arrested if you were like, you shouldn't have Napoleon's pistols, right? And it sounds like if you do, that's like a, like you're dealing in stolen goods essentially.
And I did think, you know, there were several things here that also make you, things that J.K. Rowling would have brought into Harry Potter. Like, there's definitely a Diagon Alley vibe here. Weird hate towards certain groups of people. I guess that's here. But yeah, that in the incantations. I mean, obviously that's a really old thing, but definitely. There's kind of a through line. Like, this is like the world of Hogwarts, like not functioning properly or something.
And just to add to the, I mean, maybe I'm the one looking into this one, but to add to what felt like subtle racist undertones, this like fantasy world's called Naboombu, which is just, the word makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Not too far from Nibiru, I guess, but yeah,
I think it was just coming straight off a Jungle Book. It felt like something that they cut out of the first Jungle Book was calling the city Naboombu.
Yeah, I was just trying to like take it in a different direction, so I don't feel as bad about it. So, but Nibiru, sure, why not? The animated section here isn't that long, but yeah, like you said, the fish. We basically see the king straight out of Robin Hood, which I guess was a, you know, being produced about the same time. Isn't that the king from Robin Hood we see?
Yeah, there was a lot of kind of recycled elements, it looked like, in this one. And I did a little digging. I was looking through the IMDb trivia and then following a bunch of rabbit holes, but apparently that particular scene where they'd had the animation frustrated Angela Lansbury to no end, because she wanted to improv and she wanted to kind of inject her little stuff into it, but because the animation, I guess, had been done before the live action, there was absolutely no improv, you know, you couldn't improvise at all, because it would have thrown off all of the pre-done animation at that point. So I guess that limiting, you know, creativity really got to her on this movie and made it less enjoyable to her.
Oh, good she never did Star Trek then.
Yeah.
The show's being notorious for no improvisation, please stick to the script. But yeah, it was the shoes. I was like, we see those animated shoes for a while after the main animated sequence. I was like, oh, these, getting back to Roger Rabbit, which you don't want me to compare this movie to, but I was like, those must be like the shoes Judge Doom will murder in Roger Rabbit.
I mean, it's a fine comparison, because they are separated by what, like 20 years or so.
Yeah. We do want to talk about the song lyrics, of course, but I just wanted to bring up one other thing, is the Old Man Brigade kind of stuck with me. I mean, I'm sure that's definitely a thing that was happening at the time, but it's like the opposite of the Children's Crusade, I guess. The old men just stay at home pretending to be soldiers.
Maybe, or it could have been like the Adventure Club.
Yeah. Although I guess you might, especially if you're on the coast, you might expect some kind of like sudden invasion in the middle of a war, especially early on, because I don't think the Battle of Britain, they say August 1940. When was the Battle of Britain, before or after that? I don't remember.
And I mean, this is tangential, but related, because there was another old men's club that got affected by World War II. Again, on a little bit of a tangent, but like the Jekyll Island Hunt Club, that was off the coast of southern Georgia, essentially on Jekyll Island, right outside of New Brunswick, I believe.
Oh yeah, and we had class trips there.
What's that?
I had several class trips to Jekyll Island.
Okay, so you know about Jekyll Island, and this is basically where the Federal Reserve was passed. They actually have a dining room called the Federal Reserve Room where they signed all the papers and they, you know, did all their dastardly plotting. But the only reason that Jekyll Island essentially got shut down was because the government did not like the idea that J.P. Morgan and Joseph Pulitzer and the Warburgs and like all of the money in the entire country, you know, the Rockefellers, didn't like the idea that they would all be in one tiny little consolidated place that was off the coast and perhaps subject to U-boats or just being taken out. So the government essentially annexed the island and took over it and told them, like, you know, go make your club somewhere else. We don't need you guys getting killed and ruining the entire country and the economy.
But that was now, though,
basically an old man's club.
I think also fourth grade was a class trip there. I think I was in the Boy Scouts. I think we took a trip there. And I do remember, even this would have been the 80s or 90s, but basically when you're there, you do all your stuff on the south end of the island and you don't go to the north end of the island. Like, that was still kind of off limits ish.
Well, until recently, and recently as in the last 10 to 15 years, they've slowly been, you know, kind of fixing up the island. But for a longest time, you couldn't get there unless you got there illegally, essentially. And they had a big problem with people rowing over to the island and breaking into the homes and taking all of the old plates and the china and the dishes and stuff. But at the same time, it was completely neglected. So no one even knew if you were going there and taking stuff. But they've since refurbished all of the different major houses and turned them into hotel rooms and stuff. Okay. So it's definitely opened up way more than it probably was when you were in fourth grade.
Yeah. But I wonder if it was, we are under the impression that it was like the, you know, rich clubs and stuff even at that time, but I guess they were rotting away at that point in time.
Once the U.S. government annexed it for World War II, that was pretty much the end of Jekyll Island Hunt Club as it was in the past.
I guess they all moved to Hilton Head at that point. I don't know.
I mean, they spread all over. Honestly, a lot of them went over to, I think, like Deer Island area, like upstate and sort of Michigan area.
Right. Okay. Song lyrics. You want to talk about song lyrics? We got a few minutes for that.
Well, I mean, I was mostly talking about the wood, metal, earth, water, fire incantation, and then the Portobello Road lyrics, where they just list out really interesting things for a Disney movie, right? So they're talking about the snipper that clipped old King Edward's cigars. They're talking about Rembrandts. I mean, when I hear Rembrandt, World War II, underground, you know, art smuggling, again, this is all Nazi goods. The Nazis stole a Rembrandt from somebody, and now apparently the witches are just kind of like using this to as exchange. So they don't have the lyrics here, but I think that in one of the redacted versions, there might have been golden teeth, which was cut for obvious reasons. They have a leather-bound book of Attila the Hun. So, like, I don't know. It's an interesting collection of things that they're finding here and the things that they're dealing in.
They mentioned history of cotton as like a boring thing. I'm like, I don't know. I've never, that could be quite interesting if you get into it. I just don't know. I'm sure there's some fascinating tales behind the history of cotton. I once heard of, you know, you can read a book about the history of sod and it's enrapturing.
Well, Disney has a Song of the South, right? So that kind of goes into that area.
Yeah, I suppose. I guess so. I don't know. I guess this movie isn't as just like straight offensive as people take Song of the South, but it seems to like touch on a lot more groups of people. I feel like there's Scottish racism in here. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. I mean, they're part of the UK. Yeah. Well, for now.
I enjoyed the premise of this movie far more than the movie itself. And it made me, and I was actually thinking just out loud here, like I didn't give a lot of thought before now, but what are the most recent live action / animated Disney movies?
Are we talking, you mean like the remakes?
Yeah, like what's the most recent movie that had an actual live action person standing next to an animated cartoon character in the movie?
Technically, I guess that would have been Pinocchio. And then I guess The Little Mermaid comes out soon. Is it a real movie? Is it just on streaming? I don't know. Have I watched any of these?
Wait, does Pinocchio have traditional animation?
Oh no, 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 no. You mean,
well, like that's what I mean, style. Like Roger Rabbit or Bedknobs and Broomstick style.
Oh, okay, okay. That's a harder question, isn't it? What have we seen? It has to be Disney. Because after there were a few after Roger Rabbit, like, but not Disney. I think there was like Cool World or something.
Yeah, the Cool World's the only other one I can really think of.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there was a handful of like, you know, niche ones, but as far as major motion Disney movies go.
Yeah, that's probably the end of the road, because once CGI starts showing up, when that happens, it's going to be with CGI stuff now. So, I mean, sometimes you don't know if the movie you're watching should be called animated or not, you know?
So Bedknobs and Broomsticks might actually be towards the tail end of these live action animation combinations.
Yeah, I think that's part of why the VH box appealed to me, because there weren't that many options. What else was there? There would have been a Saludos Domingo. No, I can't remember the 40s ones mix or not. Yeah. So there aren't that many. I mean, I think I did see Song of the South as a kid, and that was the appeal for me, because obviously I wouldn't have noticed the subtext, right? I'm just like, hey, here's a bear and a rabbit on screen with people. That's cool.
It does make me appreciate Roger Rabbit all the more when you see everything else that you can compare to it. It feels like that's the pinnacle of what can be done when you put, you know, all actual your effort
budget into it. Yeah. I mean, this is not like a frontline movie. You know, that's part of, again, Disney has not figured out how to properly do live action yet in 1971. So, the formula just, it needed, you know, money and like a good director, that sort of thing.
And we didn't mention this one. I thought this was an interesting tidbit, but this movie was essentially the last major Disney movie that the Sherman brothers worked on. And from what I understand, and I'm sure I'm missing all sorts of interesting context and nuance here, but basically Walt decided that the movie was too long based on some feedback that he got from theaters and, you know, business reasons, and decides to cut the movie back dramatically to a shorter runtime. And
wouldn't that be Roy by this point?
Yeah, I guess so. It'll be Roy by this point. But at this point, Disney decides to make it short. And by doing that, they cut out the equivalent of about two Sherman songs. And they just do not like this. And I guess take a little bit of a stand over it. And this becomes like one of the last major, not the last movie they do, but one of the last Disney movies that they do.
Yeah, I think they still do a few ride songs after this, but like that's dealing with different people too, I suppose.
They do, and then they come back in like the year 2000. They did another one. I can't remember what it was, but they took a, you know, more than a decade break from working with Disney, and it sounds like it was one of the straws that broke the camel's back on this one was getting some of their songs cut.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine they didn't like the hybrid nature of the Jungle Book either. So, although the best song wasn't theirs, but that's the unfortunate truth in that case. I guess we should talk a little bit about the weird ghost army at the end, where you have all the telekinetically, or just, I guess, not telekinetic, they're not controlling them with telekinesis, but the magically alive suits of armor and things coming to wage battle is pretty trippy in a way.
Yeah, I actually was probably my favorite part of the whole movie, and I wish there was more of that and less of the hybrid animation, because this was like actual suits of armor that I assume they were suspending on nylon or something, right?
Oh yeah, and there's a lot of like composite shot stuff, which I like seeing, because it's like, wow, that was hard to do. It doesn't look perfect, but you appreciate it.
I mean, practical effects win me over, even if they look a little bit cheesy. Like even when we were watching Mary Poppins, right? Like the stupid table gag with the bag, even though you know it's like, oh, there's a mirror there, or there's like a little bit of a crude green screen kind of thing going on, it's still fun to watch, even though you know how it's working. And this is kind of the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, my note was what, let's defeat the SS with whimsy. I mean, I don't actually think this was the SS, but saying let's defeat the German army with whimsy just didn't have as much punch to it. at my job, this is a bit of a tangent, but we have summer school, spring school, and when we're making files and stuff, you always abbreviate. So all over a computer, it says things like SS plans. You know, SS schedule. So yeah, just because we don't want to write.
You always feel like you're doing like some horrible plotting when you go into your lesson plans.
Yeah, exactly. So it's fun. I guess we're running a little low on time here. So are there any other major hot takes you have on really either movie?
Well, so you have a note here, and I just want to state this quote out of context. I'm all right, except for my bleeding ass. That was an interesting one, especially for a movie about bed knobs and broomsticks, two things that would definitely result in that.
Although I believe that I wrote that for the Gnomobiles fishhook.
Oh, okay. So. Okay. I was wondering where I'd seen that one.
But yeah, in terms of our podcast, we have them in the same context. So that's cool.
And honestly, I'm just so happy to even have found out about Gnomobile. I want to highly recommend it, not because it's good at all, but it is just such a weird fever dream of a movie. And it just felt like someone did a lot of coke in the Disney, you know, company and was like, I'm going to make this movie and I'm going to do it in a weekend. And they were like, oh, yeah, sure, whatever, guy. And he just grabbed a bunch of cameras and ran out the door and saw the Mary Poppins kids on the way out. And he's like, get in the car, Mary Poppins kids. And they just shot the movie over the weekend. And it turned out exactly what it would seem like. And
I really hope the person you're describing is Walt Disney, because this is Gnomobile and Jungle Book are the last ones he was personally involved in.
Is really Gnomobile one that he was personally involved in? I didn't look into the actual production history of that one.
Yeah, it's because Jungle Book, he had a lot of influence in, but died before they finished it. I think he might. I mean, Gnomobile, he is live action, so I mean, he might have.
That's amazing that this might have been the last sort of like piece of Hollywood that he was actively involved in was freaking Gnomobile, which no one even knows about.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's like a Let It Be Abbey Road thing where you do Let It Be first and then Abbey Road, but just because of production issues, Let It Be becomes the last one. And then maybe that's kind of how it worked out.
I would love to know more of the backstory, like whose passion project was Gnomobile. You know, it didn't come from Grimm's Brothers, but did it come from like a story? I guess these are the questions that I should have figured out before we started talking about it. But man, Gnomobile is just a nice rabbit hole that you can just sink into.
It's quite difficult to find information about it. As you said, it's quite difficult to find the movie.
Yeah, no, it was not easy for me to find. I had to dive deep into like 8 years of Usenet history, and I found it hidden back there.
But yeah, I guess we'll wrap this one up today. So it's the middle of March. What's up for you?
Oh, actually, I've got a brand new book that just released today. And it's called Block Man and Punch. And it's sort of a parody and something that pays homage to classic superhero comics. This one was written by Miguel McKenna. And basically, it's about a guy named Block Man who can block any attack. That's his power. He can just block anything. And his sidekick, Punch, who can just punch really hard, but he can only throw one of them. But it's a really, really hard punch. And they basically go and have to discover and fight back against the Illuminati. There's also Nazis in the very first scene.
Like bed knobs and broomsticks.
Well, yeah, because basically they find each other. They realize they have superpowers. And they're like, well, what should we do now that we have superpowers? Like, well, we have to go and find and punch Nazis, obviously. So it turns into there into surfing sharks. Then they find a guy named Sheldon P. Company, who is a turtle that actually runs all of the global conglomerates for the Illuminati. And then they go and find the Illuminati, and it's got all of the same characters you would expect to see there. It's a really funny read. So yeah, Block Man and Punch, that's the new thing that I've got promoted right now.
Okay, sounds groovy. I think my mental image when we go Illuminati is still the Illuminati group from the Metalocalypse cartoon several years back.
Do you remember Minora Team too? They had a really good one.
Oh yeah. I just,
that was another short-lived Adult Swim animation.
Yeah, I watched too much Metalocalypse, so as for this, it is A Call at Disney. You can find us as such on Facebook and Twitter. We're under the Patreon podcasting umbrella of Podcastio podcastiest, where we're about to start changing some gears. We've been doing the Sci-Fi Sanctuary, and we're keeping the format, but changing the flow, where we've taken the top 100 and bottom 100 rated movies as IMDb raters have rated them, and we juxtapose them. So we do the 100th best movie followed by the 100th worst movie, and work all our way up to number one. And that means we have to watch Human Caterpillar 2 and 3, but not 1. that's part of the thing. It's like, you know, I'd never watch Human Caterpillar otherwise, I think. But
have you seen the first one?
No, that's part of the charm. Like, because it's not on the list, we're not going to watch the first one. We're going to go straight to 2 and 3.
Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, the first one is its own thing, man. It doesn't even fit in IMDb scale, but yeah, I could see sequels just being, you know, cash ins.
I've already got a guest booked who definitely knows one for that one. So someone there will know enough. But yeah, as for myself, we're like intentionally not watching it. So anyway, we're getting that started in April, which I'm saying it live now, but I think we're going to go with the, title films and filth, the Citizen Kane of podcasting. So that being the subtitle. And then, you know, you decide, okay, we just watched the film, so is it film or is it filth? So no John Waters in on the top bottom. I mean, I love John Waters, but I just feel like, you know, you might find Pink Flamingos in there, and it's not, so we don't have to deal with the filthiest people alive, at least.
Is the room in there? Is the room in the bottom 100 anymore?
Oh, it is surprisingly not near the bottom. It's like 67 or something. Yeah. Citizen Kane itself is only like 87 best. So it's not as high on the list as you might think. Keep in mind, this is IMDb user ratings. My co-host hates the idea of rating things. So that's part of the conceit that he thinks that rating things is stupid. So... Anyway, that's upcoming, and then yeah, the first two are going to be Ikiru, the Akira Kurosawa film, and 2001: A Space Travesty with Leslie Nielsen. Those are the opening two movies.
I didn't even know that was a movie. I have to look that one up.
I remember. I mean, I've never seen it, but I remember seeing that it existed.
I wonder if it was one of his his QVC style like infomercial movies, like the golf one.
Yeah, I think it's in that area of time. So. Okay, I guess we're going to close it out today, because you got some places to be and I got some places to be. So next time is Robin Hood, I believe. So
I don't know if I want to look into the history of any of the production. I think I might just watch it and make observations first. I don't know.
Okay. Hey, if I have to watch Human Centipede 2 and 3, then Caterpillar, whatever it is, then you have to look into Robin Hood.
Yeah, but the thing is, no one's going to have their heart broken by finding out the people that made Human Centipede might not have been, you know, great people. You know what I mean? Like, that's not going to ruin that for you, but it might, you know, add a little bit of a different tint to freaking Robin Hood, which practically raised me.
Okay, there's our cliffhanger for you then. You can come back next time and see how it works out.